From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Every age has its fears and heroes, its telling ambiguities. German journalist and historical fiction writer Oliver Perch was raised on stories of his own family's history as executioners in Bavaria, going centuries back to days of witchcraft fear and the dawn of science. He wrote about it in The Hangman's Daughter. Now he's back as all the world watches Germany in the midst of Euro crisis. This hour on Point, history, Germany, and the human condition. You can join the conversation. Have you read The Hangman's Daughter? Are you watching Germany atop the Euro crisis? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Oliver Perch joins me from Munich. He spent years as a radio personality on Bavarian radio. His first book, The Hangman's Daughter, was published in English by Amazon Crossing in 2010 as an ebook and became an international bestseller. His new book, The Dark Monk, is the second in his Hangman's Daughter series. Oliver Perch, welcome to On Point. Glad to have you with us.
Hello, Tom.
We've got a lot to talk about with you, our German friend. Your country is
You're
right in the middle of all this German thing right now.
It is. We have the Greek elections today. You know that.
Greek elections, the G20 meeting going on. Your Angela Merkel there saying we won't budge, but now maybe Germany is budging. The whole sense of Germany is holding the key to whether or not the Euro crisis is solved or falls apart, the shape Europe takes. And then you, with your wonderful tales from centuries back, behind all that, you're going all the way back here to the 17th century. And executioners? What put you on this road? Was it just family history, Oliver?
Yeah, it's a family history. So I'm the descendant of a very famous executioners dynasty in Bavaria. So I've got 14 executioners in my family. But you don't have to be scared. So the last executioner in my family, he died in 1807. So that's a long, long time ago. But it always was a subject in our family, and we were talking about this. And when we were hiking in the Alps, for example, in the mountains, my mother told me bloody details when we get bored there in the mountains. And so I learned a lot about my family. And when I grew older and became a personality for radio and television, I decided to make some magazines about this because it's very, very exciting and very interesting.
Tell us about, we're going to look at the current situation as well, but this history in a funny way may inform things in a roundabout way. But just on the subject of famous executioner families, that is not a familiar idea to me, or wasn't until I picked up your books. In most of our depictions of executioners from centuries ago, they're just anonymous guys, maybe in black hoods. Yeah, we don't think of whole lines of families specializing in this with a kind of particular view of life, the human body, and so on. What was the special culture and role in German society of the executioner family?
Yeah, that's right what you said, because usually if you watch television or read books, the executioners, the hangmen, have just a little small role there. So they're just the evil guys, and then they're away.
Just bring down the axe and be gone.
Yeah. That's it. But there were much, much more also in the small villages in Germany. So the executioners in these times, they also were for example, the garbage man in town. They even were the pimps. So there were the skinners, and
skinners, and in skinners of animals, of hunted
animals. That, you see, everything which is quite blah, nobody wants to do something, wants to see this. This my ancestors had to do. But the most interesting thing for me was that the executioners in these days were not only the killers, they were the healers in town. So even the poor people, they didn't go to the physician because this was too expensive for them. They went to the midwife, they went to the barber, and they went to the hangman, to the executioner. He was the healer for the poor people. And this is a quite interesting character. So the one who kills the people heals them at the same time. And this was one of the reasons why I said I have to write some novels about that.
Killer, healer, garbage man, pimp, skinner of beasts, and occasional torturer as well. Take us back, because we're going to look at contemporary Europe and Germany, but take us back to the time you're setting these in the 17th century. The Hangman's Daughter was early 1600s. Now you've moved forward a little bit in this, The Dark Monk. Give us a sense for the culture of that time, the fears that obsessed people, the tension between old ways of thinking and mythology, superstition, and dawning science. Put us in that culture. What was going on?
I think the most important thing you have to know is that the 17th century in Europe is the century of the 30 Years' War. I think you heard about this war. It lasted 30 years, and you can't imagine, but it was even worse than the First and the Second World War together. So there were areas in Germany, they were completely devastated. Nobody was living there anymore. So two-thirds of the society died there. So, and we had a lot of plagues. We had that what we call the Little Ice Age. So this was a period in time where it was very cold in Europe, much colder than now. And for this reason, we had a lot of wolves there. We had a lot of highwaymen in the forest, all this. So the execution in these days had a lot to do in these days. So this is important. And this is the reason why I've chosen this period of time, because there's so much to do for an executioner in this time, and it's a very interesting time, and the people don't know much about it. It's also the time of the existence of the fairy tales, or also these grim fairy tales, you know. They have their origin often in the 17th century.
Out of all these troubles and challenges and wolves and dangers.
Yeah.
A very fearful time, and that fear comes into play in both your... both these novels, The Hangman's Daughter and The Dark Monk. I mean, you've got a population that's very susceptible to leaders manipulating them on the basis of fear, and a lot of that fear built around fear of witchcraft and wizardry.
Yeah. I mean, if there's so much fear and so much death around you, you're always looking for someone you can blame on. And this is the reason why there were so many witch hunts in this time, because if it's so cold or it's raining all the time and you can't make your harvest, or everybody's dying, you're looking for someone who can you blame on. And then it's the midwife, like in my first novel. You said she is guilty for all these things. And so how it worked in Europe in these days.
Of course, in American history, we know we have this time as well of persecution of witches and the fear attendant with that. Even so, if it weren't for your family history, the hangman seems like an unlikely hero. In your first book, he tries to look past or through these allegations thrown on the midwife, and he ends up finding some powerful people maybe implicated rather than humble midwives in what's going on. In the new book, you get into the realm, talk about powers and Europe-wide powers, into the realm of the Knights Templar. Give us a taste of where you're going this time.
So you always need a beginning, a start when you write a novel. And when I began to do my research for the second novel, I found an old document in this small village called Schongau in Bavaria, where all these stories are from.
It's far in the south, even south of Munich, up against the Alps, a little further south, you're in Switzerland.
It's close to the Alps. It's what we call the priest's corner, because we've got a lot of beautiful monasteries there, and you will you will know them when you write my book then. But I found a document, and in this document it was said that a Templar knight, a very high master Templar knight, he sold a church and some property in Schongau to some monks there. And I said, hey, Templars in Bavaria. And then I did my research, and I saw there was a ruin of a Templar castle there. They had a Templar street there. They even found big human bones in a crypt down in an old church. So there were many hints that the Templars were in this small village. And I said, well, why can't this famous treasure of the Templars, you know, this mm-hmm. famous treasure. Why can't it be in Bavaria? Everybody's expecting it in London or
Paris. A treasure maybe brought home from the Crusades.
Yeah, that's it. Mm-hmm. That's it. And I said, why can't this treasure be in Bavaria? And so this was the beginning of the book. And in this book, the executioner Jakob Kuisel and his daughter, and also Simon, this is the boyfriend of Magdalena, he's the son of the physician in town. They are on a treasure hunt. They had to solve a lot of riddles, and until they find at the end, let's say a part of the treasure of the Templars.
Young Simon, there, the physician's son, maybe the torchbearer of science, just coming in, but coming in to a time of ignorance and fear, and the exercise of power in some really difficult times. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with German historical fiction writer Oliver Perch about his Hangman's Daughter tales, a series of novels, old days of executioners and witchcraft, ignorance, fear, and where Germany stands now with Europe, with itself, with the world. Oliver Perch joins us from Munich in Germany, longtime radio personality there, who's picked up a really rich, deep vein of family history and turned it into quite a compelling series of novels that are coming out one by one in English now. Oliver, with your indulgence, I want to begin to weave a little past and present together here, because the Euro crisis is on so many minds, and people following very closely the G20 meeting in our backyard here down in Baja California, your chancellor, Angela Merkel, there. And here she was on Monday at that big meeting of economic leaders, talking about the recent Greece election, the impact on economic reform, saying that, you know, in Europe, we've always said that elections cannot call into questions decisions made together, that the deal that had been made with Greece is not going to be changed depending, no matter how the Greeks vote. This was Merkel on Monday.
I am specifically not talking about a new aid package, and I do not go in for speculation. If the reforms are carried out, that will be a good sign, but we cannot compromise on these reforms.
We cannot compromise on the reforms. Germany's been the one calling for austerity and, you know, carry your weight, pay for your past, to clear the decks for future growth. But then you've got, and I'm sure you've heard this, Oliver, you've got Europeans, Southern Europeans, Greeks saying, wait a minute, we can't all be little Germanys. We can't all be controlled by Germany. Here was leader of the radical Greek leftist party Syriza, Alex Tsipras, talking before Greece's election on Sunday. Here he is voicing some of this frustration among the Greek people toward the whole sort of German dominance here.
Mrs. Merkel must understand that she is a partner like any other in the Eurozone. She must understand that she cannot act as if other Eurozone countries are mere protectorates of the creditor countries.
We won't be mere protectorates. Oliver, we'll look more at the history and at your latest, The Dark Monk, but what about the position that Germany now finds itself in? I mean, it is kind of incredible here. 50 years after World War and all the rest, Germany very powerful again, and southern nations who were, you know, Greece was occupied by Germany, saying, back off. As a German, how do you look at this tension?
Yeah, this is quite new for us, because maybe you Americans know that more than we Germans to be an enemy for other countries, and that they don't like you just because you are a very powerful country. You
We've know had that, America. An American share of that, no question.
Yeah, okay. And this is a new feeling for us. Just one example. We've got now the European Championship for soccer, for football.
Yes, I've been and watching some of that.
Yeah, yeah. And on Friday there will be the quarterfinal between Germany and Greece.
Oh man.
Oh man, and well, it's not the German, but the Greece newspapers, they are full with, you know, this war sentences, bring us the head of Merkel and all these kind of things. This is quite new for us because we feel so unguilty. I mean, it's just we wanted to be correct all the time. And it's like you are in a family and you gave one member in the family a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And you trusted him, mm-hmm. and he doesn't give you the money back. Mm-hmm. And this
you're talking
is
about
how,
Greece or Southern Europe.
Yeah, I'm talking about Greece. Yeah, mm-hmm. And this is not how family is working. And now we have the problem that we can't just choose between two plagues. Yeah, between two deaths. If we say go out of the European Union or go out of the euro, of the currency, we won't get our money back. But on the other hand, if they stay there and have now this new what will come now, mm-hmm. We won't get the money back either. So it's very hard. And the experts in Germany, there we have experts to say Greece has to go out of the euro, of the currency. Others say they have to stay there. So nobody knows exactly what to do now.
Oliver Perch, you say it's a new feeling for Germany to be seen as the big powerful one, resisted by others or complained about by others. But of course, it's not entirely new. I mean, if you go back to World War II, go back to the rise of Hitler. I mean, that Germany was imposing itself by force of arms at that time on much of Europe. And now you've got, on the one hand, people who admire Germany very much for the way it's handled its economy, for the way it's got its books and its finances in order. Mm. On the other hand, it can seem sometimes as though Germany is saying, if you want to have the Eurozone, you must be like us. You must act like Germans.
That's what the Greece say, or some of the Greece people. But I would say you don't have to act like Germans. Just make your homework. I mean, I have to say that the Greek or the Greek state, not the Greek people, the Greek state, he cheated us for a very long time because he said, well, we're fine, we haven't got any debt, we have money, a lot of money, and it was not true.
Yeah.
It was not true. So they lied. And what can we do now? And I think, but they need a longer time. So that's what, when Angela Merkel says now we will correct nothing, I think it's not true. They will correct something. They will give them more time to give the money back. That's what the Greece people definitely need, more time.
The word coming out of the G20 is that maybe, in fact, something like that will happen, that there's going to be some flexibility shown at last. But in May, this was before your German parliament, Chancellor Angela Merkel was saying, look, we can't have liability held in common for these debts and then control left to individual nations.
We do want Europe. We do want more Europe. But I want a Europe in which it's always made certain that joint liability and joint control are always connected. It cannot be that liability is common and control is left to individual nations.
The German Chancellor before the German Parliament there, Angela Merkel, what are your conversations like, Oliver Perch, there in Munich? I mean, what's this Europe going to look like? Do you think, in fact, there are different cultures here. Germany historically has been very aware of its particular culture, very proud of it. At times, like other powerful nations, willing to push it on to other countries. What does Europe look like if it sticks together? Does it have to have a more common culture? Does it have to have a more Germanic culture?
We wanted to create a United States of Europe. Mm. That's what we wanted to create. Like there is the United States of America. But the difference is that we have very different cultures. This is the one thing, and the worst thing is that we've got very different economies. So I think this is different to the United States of America. I mean, the economy is quite the same everywhere, and this doesn't work. And I think if we want to have a United States of Europe, we have to be one state. In when we say economy. And this doesn't work. I mean, it can't be that you've got so poor countries like there is Greece and on the other hand the Germans. So if we want to have this United States, we have to build one general country. And I don't think it's the time now. This needs a long, long time. Let's say 20, 30 years more.
But if you don't get it now, it may fall apart now. It may not be available 20 or 30 years from now.
It won't. I think if I read sometimes the newspapers from the United States, I have the impression that you think houses are burning in Europe.
Well, metaphorically, I think that is our impression. Of course, not literally.
Yeah, yeah.
But
that's not true. I mean, even in Greece or in Spain, Portugal, so that's the countries they are talking about now, the states, the people, they do not starve there. They have maybe a better healthcare system than they have in the States.
Yeah. But we see the dire concern about that, about the EU itself and the Eurozone. I mean, it's evident. I understand people are living their daily lives. Oliver Perch is with us from Munich in Germany, radio journalist there, also historical fiction writer. The Hangman's Daughter was his first really interesting look, and we'll go deeper into it, into 17th century German culture, sort of backwaters, the executioner and all the rest. His latest is The Dark Monk, but we're also looking at this pressing reality right in front of the world, Europe right now, around the Eurozone and Germany's role, present and future in that. We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Oliver, let me take a call from Somerville, Massachusetts. Sophia is calling. Sophia, you're on the air with Oliver Perch.
Hi, Tim. Yes, I am.
Hi.
And I'm very pleased to be on the air with Oliver.
Mm-hmm.
Hi.
Hi. So I wanted to ask Oliver, I was listening to, with a lot of interest, to his point about how Germans are not accustomed to being in the position that they're in. I happen to be both a political scientist and I'm half German and half Spanish. And I find it kind of difficult to believe that there's so little consciousness in Germany, as is sometimes suggested in these comments, about the extent to which the German economy's recovery in the early and mid-2000s, or the recovery from the very difficult economic situation that Germany was in during that time, was largely premised on Germany belonging to the Eurozone, which provided it with a kind of captive, large market of countries that were going to, through different economic circumstances, and that provided much of the demand for the German export industry.
Yeah, sure.
Is there any sort of awareness that, you know, when Germans think about our money, in many ways that money has been made thanks to the Eurozone?
Yeah, Oliver, how about it? They borrowed all that money and spent it on the products Germany was making and made your recovery happen. What about that?
Yeah, I mean, you're definitely right. But if there is an awareness in Germany about these things, because if there wouldn't be an awareness, the Germans would say, let's go out of the European Union, or let's have the D-Mark, the Deutsche Mark, back. So we know this. We know this. We are the richest state in Europe because we have the euro. For sure, and because of our exports, and we wouldn't be so rich if there was no euro. So, and this is what Chancellor Merkel is saying, and what all the parties saying. So, there is no party in Germany except the, well, let's say the real extremist party, who says let's get out of the European Union or let's get out of the euro. So, in Germany, is a big awareness that we need the other countries, definitely.
Sophia, how do you think this is going to work out? Do you see Germany saying be more like us, or just saying be responsible?
You know, the thing about Germans saying be responsible, first of all, the situation in some of these different countries, Greece versus Spain versus Italy, are so different. They have such different dynamics. So we know that, for instance, in the case of Spain, it was essentially that interest rates were lowered when the euro started, largely because countries like Germany were going through a difficult economic time at that point. Mm. And more people got to work in a place like Spain. More people entered the job market, and more people bought housing. So the situations are very different, I think. But it seems as if now everything hangs in the balance, and it really is because of the way things have worked out, largely in Germany's hand, I think, to persuade, and at the hand of German elites, to explain this to Germans in a very open way, that really the German recovery was made possible by the Eurozone, and that you cannot just say, you cannot just talk of profligacy or bad habits, low productivity. These things are all much more complicated than that.
But there stands the debt, and there stand the financiers, and there stand those high rates that Spain and many others paying now. But point taken, Sophia, and I'm very glad for it. I appreciate your call. How do you think it's going to play out, Oliver? Do you think it will hang together? A lot of people are still saying it may blow up, it may blow apart.
No, it won't. I'm optimistic. I think it won't blow apart, but it takes some time. And I think, as I told you before, we should give Greece more time to solve their problems, definitely. But what is the alternative? I mean, it was so important for Europe to have this European Union, not only because of the economics, this is just one reason, but the more important reason for it is a political, because as I told you before, mm-hmm. 30 years war, we had so many wars in Europe, and these wars stopped because of the European Union. So, and I think the people should get aware of this point, that it's not only the economics, it's the politics, it's the peace we need in Europe.
You don't think Germans will say, forget about it, genug, we're done, enough already here?
If you look to the to this newspapers with the big lines, have this in USA either, I think, they say that. That's right. But I hope that most of the Germans have another opinion about the European Union. And if they ask the people on the streets, they know what they have with the European Union. They know.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with German historical fiction writer Oliver Pirch about his Hangman's Daughter tales, old days of executioners and witchcraft fear, and where Germany stands now with Europe, with itself, with the world. Oliver Pirch joins us from Munich. The Hangman's Daughter was his first big e-book sensation. Now he's out very much in print with The Dark Monk. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. It's set in 17th century Bavaria. He's descended from a line of 14 executioners in the family. It was the family trade, and it is a really interesting realm that he takes us to. Oliver, lots of folks writing online on Facebook. Nancy says, I'm reading Dark Monk now. This is the latest book. Thank you, Oliver, for preventing a good night's sleep. Loved Hangman's Daughter, too. Keep writing. I know you've got two more already coming. Then on the current side, Robert says, Greece will never pay off its loans with an economy based on tourism, olive oil, wine, and lamb chops. It has to rapidly exit the Bronze Age and enter the 21st century, or exit the Eurozone ASAP. And then interestingly here, Joni writes to us on Twitter, Oliver. She says, this is interesting stuff. She said, I descend from a 1650s Dutch New York sheriff. Same one as the Bush family and Teddy Roosevelt. What about in your family's case? How was this family history held? Was it a source of shame or pride after time? How did your genealogists in the family look back on your long line of 14 executioners?
I tell you, when I was thinking about writing this novel, I was a little bit scared what my family will say about that, even the old ones in the family. I knew that the grandma, she's now 88 years old, that she... when she was young in the 30s of the 20th century, it was really taboo to talk about this subject. So, she told me that when she were children and they were on the street, the other children blamed them as executioner's children. And I mean, this was 100 years after the last execution in my family. Mm-hmm. So you see, this lasts long, this curse. But now, after writing this, my family is very proud of me, especially my mom. And I tell you, in summer, we've got a lot of relatives in the United States, and some of them will come now to Munich in summer for some autographs and just to meet me. So this makes me proud.
Oh, well, that's great. I mean, you do put a good face on it. Yes, he's the executioner. Yes, he's the occasional torturer. Mm. But he's also the man who's trying to find out the truth of what's really going on as you present this executioner. But what about the expectations of the person, man, in this role at that time? How did torture come into it? How did that figure into justice as they thought of it then?
For the people in this time, death was everywhere around them. As I told you, 30 years war, everybody's died. Maybe in your family, there were just two survivors. So death was normal in this time. Mm-hmm. So it was with executions. So they had these public executions everywhere. And the people, they had no mercy at all with the condemned there, because death was all around, I think. I read the letters of Johann Sebastian Bach, you know, this famous composer.
Of course.
And I think he had, I'm not sure, but I think he had 12 children, and 10 of or 8, 9 of them died. And if you read this letter, there's no feeling in it. It's just they died because it was normal in this time. Hanging people or having an executioner in a village was quite normal. So it was with torturing. I mean, we can't understand that in this time there was just... the people were just condemned when they confess. Without confession, no sentence. That's what they said.
So, and I mean, in your books, the powers, the Burgermeisters there essentially say, look, there's the guilty party. They tell him, torture this person until he or she confesses, and then we'll have justice and execution and be on our way.
I mean, we can't believe it because, you know, if you torture someone, he will tell you everything. But this was the law. Without a confession, no sentence. So that's how it worked.
A listener here asks about the Sanson family in France. As they also constituted a brief dynasty of executioners in the 18th and 19th centuries.
Rich hangman.
Anything comparable in England, Spain, Italy? What about it? Were there families like this all over Europe?
Yeah. There were. There were in England at the time of Henry the sixth, you know, this evil king who killed or was divorced and killed eight of his his wives, and the hangman in this time, he was a quite rich hangman. I think the executioner of the royal executioner, I'm not sure, 20,000 executions in this time.
Oh,
and he was paid one by one. So this was a lot of money. The same in France, but not, it's a pity, but not my ancestors. They were really poor because they came from this small Bavarian village and they had just, let's say, one execution the year. This is the reason why they had to do all these other jobs, as I told
skinning
you.
Skinning and pimping and picking up the garbage. The execution itself, it was by not an axe, and not hanging, it was, as you write it, by the sword, and the training for this was interesting in itself. Is it historically accurate, the way you describe it, culminating in a, you know, you must demonstrate a perfect execution to become the full-fledged executioner?
Yeah, it's right. I mean, in this time, the occupation of a hangman was a teaching profession like many others in Germany, which means you need a long education for that. And first you are apprentice, then you are a fellow guild member, and finally you are the master. And for being a master, you need a masterpiece. That's how it works. And you can imagine a masterpiece for, let's say, a carpenter is a good table, mm-hmm. but the masterpiece for an executioner was a good beheading. So they practiced that, and then there was this one day where they did their first beheading, and when they did it good, they get this, what you call, a master certification. And I've got a document from the 18th century from my ancestors where it's a certification where it's written that he's done the beheading so good that he can do now all beheadings all over Bavaria. So you needed this. Without this, no execution.
You describe your kind of fictionalized ancestor here as also an unexpected champion of science. I mean, he dealt with these bodies. He understood a lot about bodies. Maybe mm-hmm. that's where the healing came from, but it opened him to the idea of science. Is there evidence for that role in this community? We could also imagine them as prisoners of superstition. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, the executioners, they were quite curious. And I found some documents that they opened the bodies just to look into it, if it's the same like a pig or any other animal, what's the difference? And this is the reason why they were so good healers. Yeah? I mean, the other thing is they were experienced in reducing joints or putting in a splint because before that they had, while torturing, dislocated the shoulder or even broken the leg. Mm-hmm. So as I told you, they were really good healers of this reason then.
Here's a question, kind of observation from one of our listeners, Oliver. This is from Ellen, and she says, German history puzzles me. It seems somewhat parallel to America's because of waves upon waves of people coming out of the Russian steppe looking for a better life, and because of having lots of independent and self-sufficient principalities. And yet it came together into a unified force outside of the Vatican, ultimately, thanks to Luther, outside of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And modern Germany has been like a pendulum between success and failure, reason and extremism. It's a little unnerving. What do you say to that, Oliver?
Definitely true. I mean, you know, there are some German words which are international. I think one is Kindergarten, but one is the German Angst, so the German fear. Yeah. This is quite typical for the Germans. They are always scared. And so the pendula is this is a good picture for that, I think. And sometimes we go, just if you look, I mean, we are the country of Beethoven. We are the country of a lot of famous philosophers, of Johann Sebastian Bach. On the other hand, we are the country of Adolf Hitler and National Socialism.
So do you think Germans will ultimately be able to really live intimately with, you know, Greeks, let's say, or Spaniards, who may have just a different sense of the world or the way to do things? Or will that be the thing that Germans feel like they need to drive out or change?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe you're right. I mean, the Germans.
No, I don't know. I honestly don't know.
Yeah, I'm thinking about that now. But it's the Germans are so correct. You know, we are just in time and everything. And the Greeks are the opposite of this. I mean, this is the pendula in Europe, you can say, between Germans and the Greek people. Yeah. But on the other hand, we love them. You know, we wanted to be like the Mediterranean people,
right,
like the Italians.
Put on the flip-flops, go to the beach, enjoy the sun.
Why can't we do this?
Steve, in Charlotte, Tennessee, you're on the air with Oliver Perch.
Hi, Tom.
Hello.
I have had a grandmother, and I guess eighth or ninth great grandmother back, that was actually beheaded in Germany at that time period.
Why?
They believe she was a witch. Her husband was a pastor in the Lutheran Church. He was, I think, 88, and he had passed away, left her a widow with a couple of kids. And from what I understand, that made her easy pickings.
Vulnerable. Yeah.
Yes, very vulnerable. So anyway, she was accused of a witch and actually beheaded. So.
What part of Germany? Do you have any idea, Steve?
I'm up in the northwestern corner. Gemmenden, I believe, is the name of the place. The church that my ancestor was a pastor of, it was 700 years old when he was there, and that church is still there today. So
what was the name of the village? Gemmingen? Or what was the name of the village you told me?
It was in Gimmenden, I believe, was the name.
In northwest Germany, sort of up towards Denmark or Schleswig-Holstein somewhere.
No, this is, if it's Ingen at the end, it's the southern part. I hope it was not one of my ancestors. I'm sorry for that.
Well,
that's what I heard. I was thinking this is very interesting that your ancestors may have been one of them that did that.
It's amazing that your family, Steve, could hold on to this story from history for all these generations. I mean, you'd think it might have been lost or even buried. How do you know about it, Steve?
Well, a person did a lot of research at that area, went to the church, and actually did the research on our family. So we go back to the 1400s. He's gone all the way back that far to where our ancestor actually Latinized. Their name was Krekel, and they Latinized it into Kricelius or Kricelius, and that's how we've been able to track that down through the years.
Steve, I'm so grateful to you for sharing that story with us. Thank you very much there in Tennessee.
Yeah, great.
Oliver, who was it, as in general, who was vulnerable to being called out as a witch in those years? I mean, we know from American experience in Salem and beyond. But it sounds as though Steve's ancestral grandmother there would have been, you know, maybe just the kind of vulnerable person, a widow and soon named a witch. Who was most vulnerable to being framed up that way?
Well, it is said that there were a lot of witches, were midwives. The reason for that is that the midwives, most of them lived outside of the town. This is one reason, so they are outside of the society. Mm-hmm. And the other reason is that the midwives, when a new child was born, it was only the midwife who was allowed to get into the house with the mother, mm-hmm. not the man. The mm-hmm. man had to stay outside. And now you can imagine the man, the husband, outside, and he's thinking, "What is this?
What's going on in there?
And what's going on? Is this magic? Did she use some talismans or what?
Yeah. Yes.
And maybe this is the reason. And then the man, they were the mighty persons in these mm-hmm. villages, and mm-hmm. they said, "There's something going wrong with this." And then you just need a rain in summer or a bad harvest, mm-hmm. and then it's the midwife.
Eve is calling from Jackson, Wyoming. Eve, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Oliver Perch.
Hi, Tom. Nice to talk. I have two comments about the Germany and the Euro crisis. My first comment is, I hope that Frau Merkel remember how West Germany was bailed out by the Marshall Plan. My second comment is, I think the attitude of Mrs. Merkel towards Greece is probably the result of all the funds which have been poured in from West Germany to East Germany after 1990. And the result of that has been very, very mixed. So they're just out of a rescue mission, so to speak, and to go into another one, they might have some very much doubt that it's going to work. That's all I have to say. Thanks.
Eve, I appreciate your call. I mean, the first thing there is, remember the Marshall Plan, Germany, and how Germany was rebuilt with the help of others. Is that on Germans' minds these days?
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, the people think just like this person now did in Germany. So it's the same that we, I mean, Western Germany is still helping Eastern Germany. That's what he said.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Right.
And then the Marshall Plan helped Germany after the Second World War. And now we have to help the other countries in Europe, because then if we don't help them, we won't survive. So there is no alternative. We have to do that. That's definitely right, what he said. Yeah.
Is it personal yet at this point, Oliver? I don't know if you've been traveling in Greece lately, but I mean, is it awkward to be German on a Greek beach these days, or not that way?
Well, I tell you, it's true. I was thinking about going for holidays in Greece, mm-hmm. and well, we go now to Ireland.
Ireland. Okay.
it's true. I mean, it's and some friends told me, if you are German, I mean, I'm not Angela Merkel, so I can go to Greece with no danger at all.
Yeah.
But the people will talk about this with you, and maybe they are a little bit angry. It's true.
And on the historical side, have you ever gone back and seen the swords they used? Have you ever lifted an executioner's sword?
Pardon me?
Have you ever lifted an actual executioner's sword, the kind your grandfather, great-great-great-great, might have used?
What do you mean?
Held it in your hand? Have you ever gone back?
Oh, so sorry for that. Okay, yeah. Yeah, I've got one. I've got one. So it's not the original one, because the original one is stolen from a museum in the small Bavarian village, but I found a new one on a medieval market, and I've got it now, and I bring it to my readings, and the people love it.
Watch out. The Dark Monk is the latest in the Hangman's Daughter series. Oliver Perch in Munich, you're very generous. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. It was very interesting.
This is On Point.